In the last 10 years, especially when we're going to go out hunting and when the geese are supposed to come back and when the caribou are supposed to come back, and they don't. And it makes it very, very difficult when the weather gets so unpredictable and you don't know when the animals are supposed to be coming back or when they're supposed to be leaving. That's the hardest part, uncertainty.
In the far north of Canada, the ice that defines the land is slowly melting. For the first time, people who live there are seeing plants and animals much more familiar to those of us in the south. This is the Nature Stories podcast. I'm Samantha Brown with Atlantic Public Media, curating this podcast in collaboration with the Nature Conservancy and the Public Radio Exchange. We bring you pieces each week about the intersection of people and place. Here's There's No Word for Robin, produced by Bob Carty with the Canadian Broadcasting System.
The harbor still not being frozen at the beginning of the winter.
The ice is receding quite a bit over the years here. The ice is thinner in the winter.
1967, we have a dog race, 1st of July. Canada Day, we had dog team race on the ice. And now ice goes away, or melted away.
In the summer, permafrost is melting. There's mudslides. I think something permanent has changed.
The daily banter about weather is somehow different in the north. It's matter of fact, like it's important. Southern scientists have been noticing changes here for several decades, often observing it from afar with remote sensing devices and satellites. They tell us that on average, temperatures in Canada's western north have risen 2 to 4 degrees. That's 3 to 5 times faster than in the rest of Canada. People who live here have other stories about plants and animals and land and sea, an oral record that's much older than the scientific data and much finer in detail and meaning. As I traveled around to hear those stories, I was struck by a common thread. Ice. This is a land largely defined by ice, even in the warmer months. And recently, the ice of the Arctic Sea has provided a less firm foundation underfoot. The ice of the land, the permafrost, is melting, buckling, collapsing. And the ice of the Yukon Mountains is giving up secrets of the past and warnings for the future.
We're a short distance south of Whitehorse in the Coast Mountain Range. We're flying at about 6,000 feet, and the site we're going to is known as Friday Creek. It's just up in this hanging valley at 12 o'clock.
Rick Farnell works for the Yukon Department of Renewable Resources, and he's taking me to see one of hundreds of ice patches he's found atop the high ridges of Yukon Mountains.
This one is about 100 meters wide, and I'd say about 300 meters long. It's an alpine ice patch that has been building and contracting over thousands of years. A couple of years ago, we discovered these ice patches were melting back quite rapidly, with this could be a real strong signature of global warming.
The helicopter lands and we scramble over to the ice patch. At its base is a wide swath of rocks, a parking lot 20 meters wide of bare rocks, free of lichens and mosses. That's how far the ice patch used to reach. That's how far it's melted in only a few years. One positive note, as these ice patches melt, they're giving up ancient treasures, animal remains and human artifacts, some as much as 8,000 years old, but perfectly intact in the ice, making this one of the most exciting digs in Canada. Rick Farnell's colleague is archaeologist Greg Hare.
One of the finest pieces we found in the last 2 years was a type of hunting technology where you use a throwing board to propel a long dart. And it's this beautifully made stone point. The sinew is still very intact, holding it onto the wooden foreshaft. For most archaeologists, this would be unbelievable.
For most researchers, this would be time to relax and celebrate. But here on the ice patch, there's not just excitement, there's anxiety, a sense of rushed and frenzied work. The motherlode is melting too fast. And these researchers may be running out of time to retrieve secrets from the past. It's all because of the weather today and the forecasts for the future. Rick Farnell.
These sites are really burning up. They're melting back really fast, and our glaciologist predicts that we've only got 5 to 10 years, and they may melt back completely if the summers stay as hot as they are.
Climate change giveth and taketh away.
Yeah, and then they're no longer going to be time capsules if they melt completely back. And they could be a real important signature of global warming.
Standing here on a Yukon ice patch, it's not hard to understand what scientists are saying about the ice patches and the glaciers of the world. They're in crisis almost everywhere. Jim Bruce is a former Federal Assistant Deputy Minister of the Environment, a hydrologist, and a member of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
In Glacier National Park, which is right next to the Canadian border in the U.S., in 1850 there were 150 glaciers. Now there are 50. And by 2030, there will be none. So they're going to have to think up another name for that park.
Renaming a park could be the least of the problems. Melting glaciers could produce the worst-case scenario of climate change. If the big glaciers melt, the glaciers of Antarctica and Greenland, sea levels could rise by as much as 10 meters. That would flood hundreds of small islands and many of the world's major cities. But that's the worst-case scenario. Possible, but not imminent. There's much more certainty about what could happen to farming peoples around the world if glaciers continue to disappear. It could mean famine in India and China, and hardships for Canadian farmers, too. The water of this ice patch ends up in the Yukon River and the Bering Sea. Just a bit south of here, glaciers feed the Athabasca and Mackenzie Rivers, emptying into the Arctic Ocean. And further south still, glaciers of the Rockies feed the rivers of the prairies.
The glaciers on the east slopes of the Rocky Mountains or in the Rocky Mountains do feed the streams that go across the prairies, the Bow River into the Saskatchewan River, into the Nelson River. And these are the rivers that many cities depend on the water supply, Regina and so on. As the glaciers melt, the flows of the rivers are maintained rather well. In fact, in some cases may increase on average. But as the glaciers disappear, you end up with very dry rivers fed only by the rainfall during the year. It means that they've got to find sources of water for irrigation if they're going to maintain crops. Otherwise, we're going to see a decline in production on the prairies, in my view.
If the problem for the prairies is a declining supply of water, the problem here is the opposite. This is where the mainland of Canada looks out on the Arctic Ocean, a hamlet that calls itself the top of the world, Tuktoyaktuk.
My name is Charles Klingenberg. I'm the land and development officer with the hamlet of Tuktoyaktuk, and we're standing on the coast of the Beaufort Sea, and we're standing on the exact spot where the community curling rink used to be.
What happened?
It got washed out.
Washed out how?
The bottom got eroded, all washed out from the backwash and storms, and this is an ongoing problem. The beach where we're standing on, there's maybe about 40 to 60 feet has washed out, and those used to be comprised of some lots, but now they're all washed out.
With houses, too?
Yes, the houses, yes, they were all removed and that because the beach was going to erode and they had no choice.
As the land officer for Tuktoyaktuk, Charles Klingenberg has less and less raw material to take care of each year. The problem is erosion. A couple of weeks ago, a severe storm washed away meters of Tuk's Peninsula. Now, it's impossible to say that any one weather event is positive proof of historical climate change, but it does fit the trend. And so does today's weather. As I walk about Tuktoyaktuk with Charles Klingenberg on an August morning, people greet him with the word Apala, in Uvialuit for cold, isn't it? Makes you wonder what happened to global warming. But this kind of weather variability also fits the predictions of climate change. Charles Klingenberg has been watching the changes for years, and he's not prepared to sit by and do nothing with the hope that things will get better. The hamlet of Tuk is getting ready, building a seawall of hauled-in rocks.
And what we see right now with our beach is we got this sort of like limestone rock, big boulders, and we haul them, we're placing them on the beach as our, like our permanent shoreline protection.
How much have you spent trying to put up this rock breakwater?
The last couple of years, pretty close to $1 million.
A lot of money.
Yes.
And if there's global warming, have to spend more?
Probably if we want to save our peninsula.
Tuck does face a big challenge from loss of shoreline, and measurements have been made over the past 20 years. Some of the places around the delta there have had erosion rates in excess of 10 meters a year.
Rob McDonald is a research scientist with Canada's Institute of Ocean Sciences. Experts like McDonald say that without massive investments, the peninsula of Tuck and other parts of the Mackenzie River Delta will eventually weather away, and it will happen all the more quickly if there is climate change.
One thing we do know is that if the water stays open longer in the fall, it gives the opportunity to have more storms over open water. And that's the crucial thing, because when the storm comes over an ice-covered sea, you don't tend to get the waves. And the result is you don't tend to erode away the coastline. So if you leave the water open, you could very easily double the erosion rate just by doing something like that. The final component of this problem is that a lot of the land in the delta and around Tuck is poorly bonded permafrost, so it's not well held together. And a place like Tuck is just not that far above sea level. So any small rise in sea level, any further opening of water and having the opportunity to have one more storm a year come in just takes the land away.
Rob McDonald estimates that with climate change, the sea levels here could rise by 1/3 to 1 meter in the next 50 years. But he's not sure, in part because Canada no longer measures tides and water levels here. The Tuktoyaktuk measuring devices were taken out several years ago because of budget cuts. But Tuck's problems don't begin and end with erosion and sea level rising. The fundamental problem is the kind of ground that Tuck and much of the north is built upon.
Once you get below the active layer, which is the surface of the soil that thaws every year, it can be permanently frozen. And most of the permafrost we know in the north has been frozen for a long period of time and can be really thick, sometimes even over 1,000 meters thick.
Mark Hines is a professor of biological sciences at the University of Alaska. He explains that permafrost is made up of rocks and ice and soil and lots of very old vegetation, plant matter that hasn't decayed over millennia because it's frozen. And so it doesn't release greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane.
It's one of the largest carbon storage sites on Earth. And so as you have some warming in the north, which is certainly occurring now, this active layer at the top that's thawed will get deeper and deeper over time. And once that material is thawed, its ability to decompose is increased drastically, and that's what we're worried about. We have the potential for putting carbon back into the atmosphere at a rate that's considerably larger than in the past. We now go from a sink to a source of carbon. By heating the atmosphere, that can cause the permafrost to melt even more. And so in a way, it's kind of a positive loop on itself in which it exacerbates its own demise over time.
And the demise of Arctic tundra is a problem for the entire world. Greenhouse gases released from permafrost will eventually disperse around the globe. They'll generate more and more climate change for everyone. There is another sentinel of climate change I found on my trek through the north. It's a case where the elements affect not just land and rivers and oceans, but also the wildlife and the people who depend upon it. 400 kilometers north of Tuck, on an Arctic outcropping called Banks Island, there's a hamlet called Sachs Harbor.
Sachs is a community of about 120 people. There's no trees here. It's very, very flat, full of tundra. But the flowers here are absolutely gorgeous. Apparently, this is one of the most luscious islands in the Arctic.
Rosemary Kuptana grew up in Sachs Harbor, but she was educated in the South. She's worked on land claim negotiations and constitutional talks. But today, she's sitting in the sun on a porch overlooking the Arctic Ocean and soaking up the life of her hometown.
This is a typical summer day in Sachs where people are getting ready for winter. You've got boats coming in and out with seals. People are fishing. Some people are feeding their dogs fresh seal meat and muskoxen meat. And these dogs are very important to us now because we use them in the wintertime for hunting.
Floyd Sidney is one of the people feeding a dog team today. His dogs are yapping in anticipation because Floyd Sidney is sharpening his knives to skin and gut a muskoxen he's just killed.
Yeah, it was a bull muskoxen. Seen a black creature there to the east of the island and got the rifle and bingo. One shot, just like in the Clint Eastwood movies, when you're hunting for the bad, then the ugly gets in the way. Then the good only survives.
Floyd Sidney is another resident of Sachs who left this place to work in the south. Now he's come back for the hunting, for the ice and the ocean, for the way of life. It's not a way of life for everyone, but even a visitor can feel its attraction. The amazing silence of the tundra and its flash of summer colors. Above all, the vastness of everything. In the midst of which stand these 36 houses, connected to the rest of the world by twin otter flights every 4 days. It's hard to believe that industries and their gases could reach this far, let alone affect something so expansive and isolated. Certainly Floyd Sidney and his neighbors never expected that their way of life could be so deeply shaken by climate change.
What it does for the people's lives here, especially on the island here, is your seasons become shorter. It'll be hard to judge your harvesting times of year for whatever species of mammal you have to go after.
Where it first affected is going to be the ocean animals in the sea. If it's changing too fast, if it's melting too fast, seal pups is going to be really affected by warm weather. Very important. I mean, that's a livelihood here. We eat seal ourselves too. It's good.
See a lot of thunderstorms. Never had that here before. You see these muskox after you hear a lightning crack. The muskox, you know, they just take off and they don't know where to run. They run one direction and then the other. It was something else. Yeah, they didn't know what was going on.
In the last 10 years, especially when we're going to go out hunting and when the geese are supposed to come back and when the caribou are supposed to come back, and they don't. And it makes it very, very difficult when the weather gets so unpredictable and you don't know when the animals are supposed to be coming back or when they're supposed to be leaving. That's the hardest part. Uncertainty.
The behavior of the wildlife is not the only thing people are worried about in Sachs Harbor. There are also new critters they've never seen before. New insects that pester them in summer, the wild growth of more southerly plants, the Pacific salmon that recently showed up in the fishnets, and the birds discovered by Rosemary's brother, Roger Kuptana.
Well, I am a bird fan. I've known to just go out and observe them. I don't really know some of their names. I just happened to be outside working about, and the robin came around. Robin Redbreast, I guess. He started feeding on these flies that were flying around.
What's the word in your language for robin?
I don't know if there's... In Sachs Harbor, I don't think there is a word for a robin. None that I'm aware of anyway. So it is a robin. They're so rare here, we don't have names for them.
Jim Bruce smiles when he hears the story of Roger Kuptana's robin sighting. As a climate change expert, he knows that some species will try to move north as southern climes get warmer. But in the longer term, Jim Bruce is not sure they will succeed.
With climate change, a number of species will migrate northward. But in other cases, they simply will not be able to cope. The plants, the trees, the plant life have great difficulty moving northward rapidly. They can move over a very long period of time, and they have in the past. But the rate of climate change that we're now experiencing and expect over the next few decades far exceeds what they'll be able to accommodate. How that affects the animals, of course, is that in many cases the animals depend on plant life, and where the plant support disappears, so will the animals.
On the beach of Saxe Harbor, gentle waves lap the shore. There's no ice in sight out in the sea. That's not the way it used to be, but it's the way it's become these past few years. When the elders of Saxe talk about the weather and the environment, more than anything else, they talk about the changes in the ice. Changes that can be dangerous for hunters like John Kilgack.
Ice is not as thick as it was before. We were out polar bear hunting and the ice moved out on us. It broke away. We were drifting out in the ocean there. It's a funny feeling, you know. You're out in the ice, but there's nothing you can do. And so we had the radio and a Twin Otter to pick us up. They brought us back home here. Yeah, the ice has changed a lot, yeah.
When you tell me stories about John on the ice saying that he got stuck on the ice one time because it's so thin it cracked and it drifted him off, well, my ears perk up because I think that the ice cover is the vulnerable place, that's the thing that will change first, fastest, and most observably.
Oceanographer Rob McDonald says that once the Arctic ice starts disappearing, it may be hard to reverse the trend.
It's a white ocean when it's covered with ice, so it's very reflective. When you take that ice cover away, you allow sunlight to penetrate the ocean, and you allow it to absorb heat. Then it melts out more ice because it's warmer. Then more heat can get in, and then it melts out a bit more. So the system feeds on itself in a way. That's positive feedback. If we took the ice out of the Arctic, we would change Canada's Arctic rather drastically, and it would have immense impacts on the people and the animals that live there, no question about that.
The impact could be felt much more widely than the Arctic itself, but that's what scientists are talking about. It's a theory, and scientists are usually cautious about new theories, but this one has started a buzz and even unnerved the skeptical. It has to do with the melting of the Arctic ice and its effect on the Gulf Stream. The Gulf Stream. Most of us can conjure up grade school images of maps and flowing colors showing those warm waters from the Caribbean sliding up the side of North America and over into Britain and Europe, moderating temperatures along the way, making life bearable in those places. It's a phenomenon as strong and true as any we learned in geography class. But today, scientists like Rob McDonald say melting Arctic ice could change it all. If the Arctic releases large volumes of fresh water from precipitation, glacier runoff, and ice pack melting, it could change the Gulf Stream or even shut it down.
What that would mean for the climate in places like Northern Europe is that it would suddenly go colder. We might find that we had started to get years that had no summer. You would not be swimming in PEI. And you might also find that the ocean climate changed such that the fish stocks were not very happy there, and you lost them.
But surely that would happen over a long period of time.
Well, people who study climate have always thought that climate is kind of a slow thing, but these climate changes can happen very quickly. In fact, they can happen within a decade.
That's a surprise.
Quite a bit more than a surprise. It's very worrisome because it means that some of the impacts that we're talking about may happen suddenly to us or to our children. And these are not things that we will have a chance to adapt to very quickly if that's the case.
Like that piece of iceberg on the Beaufort Sea. May you never be that lost and lonesome schemo just like me.
On a late afternoon, Floyd Sidney belts out a country tune with slightly revised lyrics for an Arctic audience. Floyd is a flexible kind of guy. In his lifetime, he's gone from wilderness hunting to Hank Williams. He's driven trucks in Alberta, and now he's back to shooting musk oxen on Banks Island. He says he has the skills of two worlds to deal with the future. So while he's worried about climate change, he's not wringing his hands. But he is concerned about the next generation, who are more and more dependent upon the skills of the South. They've gone from Hank Williams to hard rock. In the Sax Harbor School gym, some teenage girls with a boombox are watching the boys play floor hockey. As in the South, there are dissenting views here about climate change and whether people will or should adapt to it, even if in the end, it's all that bad.
They will increase the grass and stuff, let it grow more sunshine, no more cold days.
In another 30 years, they say it's going to be mostly summer. Might actually grow trees.
Throw away the parkas.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing.
Yeah.
People will say they'll lose their way of life.
What would happen?
It's lost long ago.
Sorry, say that again?
It was lost long ago.
Well, I used to think like that too, you know. But so what, they're teenagers. But I'm still here, and I've learned a whole bunch of new things, and I think that's what's going to happen to those young people. We are going to adapt. We're an evolving culture anyway. We're not living in igloos, and I was born in an igloo. You know, I've gone from being nomadic to setting up satellite channels for Native people. We just got to do what has to be done, you know? There's nothing that we can do about it. We'll make the best of what we can with what we have.
Rosemary Koptana's confidence in her people's adaptability wasn't something I was expecting on my trip through the North. The climate changes you see here are dramatic and convincing. The predictions for the future may not be entirely accurate, but even if they're half wrong, these people may be the most affected by climate change. Ironic, since they have contributed so little to its cause. But they already have decades of practice adapting to new environments, figuring out what part of their way of life to discard, what to hold on to. And so they seemed resigned to adapt and to leave it to others to find ways to avert the crisis. It leaves a question for those of us who live in the South. How well will we be able to adapt, to decide what part of our way of life to discard, what to retain? And how carefully will we heed the warnings from the North? Jim Bruce.
I think that it's simply a feeling that it isn't going to hurt me very much, so why should I worry about doing something to change my lifestyle, to change what kind of vehicle I drive or the kind of energy I use. It's because they don't think it's going to hurt them very much. The peril is that the Arctic is only the first to experience severe changes. The rest of us will experience them later on. We're not talking about something that's going to happen 50 or 100 years from now. We're talking about something that's happening today, as you've seen in the Arctic. We're going to see it next year, the year after, next few decades, quite visibly.
That piece comes from Bob Carty with the Canadian Broadcasting System. To hear more pieces like this one, visit the Public Radio Exchange at prx.org. The Nature Conservancy provides support for this podcast, online at nature.org/stories, committed to protecting nature and preserving life. If you've thoughts or feedback, write to us at podcast@tnc.org. I'm Samantha Brown from Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Join us next week for another Nature Stories podcast.